You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 24th to the 30th of April 2014. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporters David Matthews and Holly Else and books editor Karen Shook. How much should we pay graduate teaching assistants? £10 an hour, £40 an hour? It depends very much on which university you're at, as we reveal in this week's lead news story. More from Holly on that in a second. More men should be encouraged into female-dominated areas, according to UCAS chief Mary Kernock-Cook. But how do we get more guys to consider nursing, teaching and social work? David has more on that later. And finally, Karen is here to give us our regular rundown of this week's books section. But first, Holly, glad you're here to explain this week's splash on the varying rates of pay for graduate teaching assistants. It seems a pretty complicated picture. I know you're losing your voice a little, but perhaps you could try and talk us through it.
Hopefully it'll stay around for this. So we did a bit of an investigation into how much universities were paying their graduate teaching assistants. And these are typically PhD students who help out delivering sometimes lectures, seminars, tutorials, lab groups and marking work. And lots of them actually have to do this as part of their PhD. And we found that actually the amount of pay that a university gave their graduate teaching assistants varied quite significantly. I mean, the lowest amounts that we had was about £10, and then the highest was sort of over 70. So these were for different types of jobs, probably take different amounts of preparation. But across the board, there's a massive diversity in how much people are getting paid. That's obviously an issue, but then when you actually start to talk to some of these students, what you find out is that they are actually doing a huge amount of unpaid work, because these classes or tutorials that they are asked to take a huge amount of preparation, and the hourly rate seldom covers the amount of hours that they sort of seldomly gives them enough during the hours that they're actually working for it to be a viable pay level.
Yeah, Fern Riddle, I know, wrote for us recently. She's a final year PhD student at King's, and she wrote on the subject in February and called GTA the most maligned, ignored and forgotten role in the recent debate about pay in HE. It sounds like some of the things you've uncovered here back that up. They're working hard, they're working long hours, and they're just not getting the recognition, or they're getting very varying levels of recognition.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, one guy who I spoke to at SOAS, he wanted to remain anonymous, but he basically said that his GTA work put him behind on his PhD by about a year, because he was spending so much time preparing for this tutorial that he taught for undergraduate economics it took him up 8 hours to prepare for one tutorial, and when he was getting paid for, I think, 3.5 hours work, because the university applied the UCU's recommended 2.5 multiplier to GTA work. So that means they get paid for the hour that they're actually teaching the seminar, and then 2.5 times that rate for the preparation time. But in his case, that wasn't enough, because he was spending up to 8 hours doing that preparation. And I think feeling a bit peeved by the whole thing.
Why do PhD students do this? I mean, obviously, A, for money, but is it important to kind of get on the career ladder as well? Is it important to, as experience, if you want to, become an academic afterwards?
Yeah, I think it gives them a great teaching experience, which, some of them feel under some pressure to actually have that experience on their CV if they want to become an academic. So there's a certain amount of expectations that they will do this work as part of their PhD, but realistically, some of them might need to have part-time jobs that are paid better than this, but would be not necessarily able to take those because they think this is the kind of work they should be doing.
Mm. Are they being used as a cheap labour source?
I think so, yeah.
It's a buyer's market.
Mm. There is, isn't it? Plentiful supply as well. And one thing that interested me out of that was that some institutions, the pay levels for GTA seem to vary internally. Was that right? So I read that one place. I mean, you won't need to mention it there. It's all in the piece. You should definitely go to our website and read it in full. But sometimes in one department, the GTAs were getting paid three times as much as in other departments at the same institution. I mean, that must be unpleasant for people working there.
Yeah, well, the university's comeback to that was that it sort of requires a different amount of work to prepare for these sessions, so which could be true, for example, if you're in a science laboratory and you were just helping with practical work, so supervising the students, you know, you wouldn't have to, you could just sort of turn up and do that, you might have to do a bit of reading. But if you were taking a tutorial with, say, with five students and marking all their work, that's a lot more to do, so could possibly deem a higher rate of pay. But yeah, it seems there's huge variation across the sector and even within institutions.
Mm. I've had contributors say to me as well that in their specific department at their university, the cupboard was bare, there was no money to pay for teaching assistants, but they had doctoral candidates volunteering to do it, or they kind of hinted around until PhD candidates said they would do it because they wanted to show willing and get the experience, whereas in other departments there was money for it, and it doesn't seem that it was consistently applied. So some people were working for nothing and other people were being paid.
Yeah, and then another issue actually that came out during the investigation was that you know, some departments, sort of departments make up their own rules, so they make up their own contracts, they make up their own job descriptions, which can obviously vary hugely as well.
Interesting stuff. Well, all those stats, all that data, page 6 and 7 of this week's magazine. Now, men should be encouraged into female-dominated subjects such as nursing, teaching and social work, just as science and engineering is promoted to women. That's, David, your story this week, and those are the words, paraphrased words, of Mary Kernock Cook at UCAS.
Yes, that's right. So she was speaking last week at the Conference of University Administrators in Manchester, and she made what I think is a very interesting point. I don't think she's made publicly before. So previously she has spoken about a big gender gap in HE in application rates. So women a third more likely to apply to HE than men. But she went a bit further this time and said, well, you know, there are lots of campaigns, you know, rightly to address male dominance in things like computer science and engineering. But when she talks to universities about, okay, why do you have more, you know, female students than male? They say, oh, well, we have, you know, lots of female-dominated subjects like nursing, for example. And she said, well, why are they female-dominated subjects? Shouldn't we have just as much of an effort to encourage men into nursing and social work and teaching as we do the other way around? I mean, there's, you know, I think that there've been House of Commons reports. There's, you know, whole organisations set up to get women into STEM subjects. But I don't think, I had a quick look, and I don't think there's really the same thing on the other way around. There's no kind of men into nursing. And she had this great graph that we actually reproduced, and it looks at, okay, how many students would you need in each subject, either extra men or extra women to kind of balance it up. And it's extraordinary. I mean, you've got three where you'd need more women: computer science, sport science, and mechanical engineering. But they're kind of really dwarfed by the numbers you'd need to balance up things like nursing, psychology, social work, English, design, teacher training, that kind of thing. So, and you know, her broader point is that, you know, there's a real social almost a crisis really for men and their access to HE. You're as likely to apply for HE as a man as you are to get into HE as a woman. Mm. And she thinks, you know, that we need to have these basically campaigns to get men into these female dominated subjects.
So campaigns is the answer, like an Athena swan for getting men into these areas.
Yeah, I suppose
was there a suggested, you know, remedy?
Yeah, I mean, she didn't really go into massive details, but I suppose Athena swan's more about career researchers. I think she's talking more about kind of students, really. I mean, makes the point that, you know, nursing, social work, teaching, and so on have actually quite a, you know, they're quite employable subjects. There's always going to be lots of jobs in those areas, and men are perhaps missing out on those. So, but yeah, certainly some kind of campaign I think she was asking for.
Maybe if those jobs had higher esteem and higher pay, more men would want to take them.
Well, I'm sure they'd rather have them than no job at all, wouldn't they? But yeah, it's a fair point.
Mm. Well, interesting stuff. Page 8 of this week's magazine, also at timeshighereducation.co.uk as well, of course. Cam, this week's books section, what do you have lined up for us?
A movable feast of academics doing unusual things. We have a classicist who is also a fan of Dolly Parton, and she's written her account of taking a pilgrimage to Dollywood and also to the replica of the Parthenon in Tennessee with its life-size statue of Athena in slightly better nick than the old one from Greece, and with flashing eyes as well. We've also got Deborah Rogers reviewing the much-talked-about book The Triple Package, What Really Determines Success. This is written by Jed Rubenfeld and Amy Chua. Amy Chua is perhaps best known as the author of the book Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. This new book talks about what you need to succeed. You need to be from a cultural group that sees itself as better than others. You need to yourself think you are not good enough, so that you need to control yourself and resist temptation. And our reviewer concludes by saying that perhaps the Jewish mother need not be Jewish, but in her experience it helps. This week we also talk about early modern science and English virtuosi. We have a book by Richard Yeo where he discusses the fact that the idea that the early modern scientists such as Bacon and Locke were doing their own work and not collecting commonplace books, which was what an earlier generation did, sort of, I'll note this down for later, here are the great thoughts of other people, wasn't entirely correct. And in fact, a lot of these 17th century academics were developing things that the technology wasn't even capable of compiling, an arcus studorium, a kind of filing cabinet in which different pieces of paper could be shuffled between various hooks. And one academic, Samuel Hartlieb, who had a 300,000-word log of every project or contrivance that came to his own ears. So obviously these were people who were crying out for big data in an era when big data meant revolving filing cabinets. We've also got a memoir from Michael Rogers, who works in academic publishing. He's an eminent editor and the person who brought us the first works of a young chap called Richard Dawkins. Another new college don suggested that if he was quite lucky, Dawkins' book might be like Desmond Morris's The Naked Ape. And also this week, our book of the week is by Prue Shaw, an eminent scholar of Dante from the University of Cambridge, originally from Australia, who recalled coming to the University of Oxford to do her second degree and was incredulous to see a mature man working on the front desk in the university library addressing a pimply-faced undergraduate as Sir. She recalls, the deference was creepy. Anyway, her book Reading Dante From Here to Eternity attempts to convince those of us who never quite managed to read the Divine Comedy to actually do so. It's not intended as crib notes. It really is intended to have you set your fear aside, even if you don't read medieval Italian. And she makes an extremely good case, according to our reviewer, Elena Lombardi.
I've never read it. I've listened to a lot of the Divine Comedy in band form. Anyone here actually, actually read it?
But as far as the medieval Italian thing, rather than the band from the 90s.
I think I need to get over my fear. Very good.
This might be the book to convince.
Well, yeah, apparently so. Before we go, I should flag up two things. On Monday, the inaugural Times Higher Education Young University Summit takes place in Miami. I'll be tweeting from that. There'll also be stories online. This week's cover feature sees Deputy News Editor John Morgan report from Cyprus's buffer zone, where a new private campus has attracted controversy and flack from the UN. Fascinating read there about, I think it's UCLan, isn't it?
That's right.
Over there. So that's also very much worth checking out. But until next week, that's the end of this Issue Review podcast. You can find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, on Google+, in all the usual places, and of course at timeshighereducation.co.uk. But that's all from this week's Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.